The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Woke up this morning with my mind.
Ooh, it was
set on freedom.
Woke up this morning with my mind.
I happened to be walking with anything on my mind this morning. But anyway. Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom, walking and talking with my mind stayed on freedom. These words were a rallying cry in the civil rights movement in the 1960s. They were sung during marches and protests seeking civil liberties long denied to people of color in this country. I'm inclined, though, to consider that our minds are stayed on freedom in a larger context. Aren't our minds every day focused on freedom? Not just in the context of civil liberties, especially today when sadly those liberties are under daily attack, but also in the larger context of freedom of mind, of spirit, freedom from fear, from anxiety, from ego, and beliefs that limit our ability to align with and to express our true self. Freedom from social pressures and attachments that make living a balanced and peaceful life difficult, if not at times seemingly impossible. Right? Freedom from thoughts, words, and actions that undermine our sense of self-worth and of being connected to others and to the interdependent web of all existence. This wider, expansive view of freedom is captured in the verse from As Tranquil Streams. You know, that's the hymn that commemorates the merging of the Unitarian and Universalist faith communities, and that affirms our commitment to build a religious community that shall be free. Free from the bonds that bind the mind to narrow thought and lifeless creed, free from a social code that fails to serve the cause of human need. We UUs affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. That search involves a quest for spiritual freedom, freedom of mind and spirit, freedom to develop religious faith and moral principles that guide us in realizing our potential, building relationships with others, and connecting with the interdependent web of all existence. So this morning, let's explore a pathway to spiritual freedom suggested by seers and writers, philosophers and psychologists. It's one of the oldest and most powerful ways that we create and express meaning in our lives: storytelling. As psychologist Dr. Dorothy Susskind puts it, the stories we tell ourselves are a reflection of our inner lives, mirroring how we experience the world and define our identity. Writer, historian, and activist Rebecca Solnit writes that the stories we tell ourselves are not just central to our identity, but also to our freedom. You know, freedom in many aspects, of course, is the Soul Matters theme for our services this month. Solnit writes, "We are our stories, stories that can be both prison and the crowbar to break out of that prison." That's so true, isn't it? We need stories to make sense of, to organize our experiences of the world. And those stories we construct can confine us or liberate us. And that's especially true of stories involving family members and family relationships. And since today is Father's Day, we'll focus on narratives related to fatherhood that reveal their power to liberate us or to limit us. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee here at the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, and on behalf of the worship committee and the fellowship as a whole, I welcome you, whoever you are, wherever you may be on your spiritual journey, on your life's journey, whatever you must in conscience truly, responsibly believe, however you identify or express your gender, whomever you love, whoever loves you. You are beloved and welcome here and invited to worship with us this morning as we peer into how we characterize fathers in our cultural and personal narratives. But first, as we do whenever we gather as a community, let's declare ourselves ready to engage in the worship experience by lighting our chalice. Tony Black, longstanding member of our fellowship, who has served our faith community in many roles, currently as a member of the TPUF care team, right, will conduct our chalice lighting this morning.
The chalice and the flame are symbols of our free faith, signifying our openness to the wisdom of many ages and many traditions, and our commitment to keep the flame of truth, justice, and compassion burning in our hearts and in our world. These words are from a Father's Day prayer by the Reverend Kristen Grassel Schmidt, who is co-senior minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Berkeley, California. For all who father, for all who have warm and loving relationships with their fathers and their children, for those who, for whatever reason, did not know their fathers, we will try to remember that this may be a difficult day for you and for others. And for those whose relationships with their fathers or their children is painful or complicated, we support you. This Father's Day, we lift our gratitude for all kinds of fathers and for the amazing ways that fatherly love transcends bloodlines and legal categories. It is our tradition here to also remember our wish for peace by lighting the peace lamp. Join me with the responsive reading. May peace be with us, with all the people of the world.
Thank you, Tony. Now let's sing together our gathering song, hymn number 323, Break Not the Circle. The circle of enabling love, that is. The choir of the First Unitarian Church of Baltimore, Maryland, leads us in singing of our aspiration to strengthen the bonds that connect us to one another, in the family circle, of course, but also in the larger human circle, where people of all ages, races, genders, nationalities, and orientations may learn and thrive. You'll find the lyrics in the gray hymnals available on the cart beside the door to the sanctuary, and the lyrics will also appear on the screen in the front of the sanctuary. Break not the circle. Before we share some stories of fathers and fathering from some fellowship members, let's devote a few minutes to read responsively a text by Lorraine Bothorff McNeil, a member and worship leader of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Tyler, Texas. Her words acknowledge the many manifestations of fatherhood and remind us of our responsibility to support fathers, as well as the need to invoke discernment and compassion in creating narratives about them, no matter how they come into their roles and regardless of their relative successes and failures. I'll lead you in this. You can see congregational responses there. And it's also in the
Number?
Page,
whatever.
I don't have it. I'm sorry. Okay, all right. All right, we ready? Today is Father's Day, a day in which we honor and offer gratitude for our fathers in whatever form or fashion they come into our lives. Biological fathers, stepfathers, adoptive and foster fathers, grandfathers, spiritual fathers, and all of the uncles, brothers, and friends who, whether they know it or not, have helped to fill the role of father in someone's life. Let us remember today and always the impact that these people have on us as individuals and as a community.
And let us also remember that this relationship is not one-sided, and that we as a community are called to support and empower the fathers of this world, no matter how they came into their roles, and regardless of their own successes.
Let us raise up their triumphs, and let us have the grace to forgive them their all too human failures. Let us love our fathers and each other. Come, let us worship together. They said our message today comes in the form of several stories we'll hear. Psychologist Lori Gottlieb is a therapist who writes an advice column called appropriately, Dear Therapist, right? And she receives hundreds of letters seeking advice. She views these letters as stories told from the standpoint of narrators who, because of their limited perspective, personal history, and emotional state, may very well be unreliable narrators. Gottlieb sees her role as a therapist to help people examine their personal stories more carefully and more completely. She encourages them to become astute editors of their stories, rework their stories to make them more comprehensive and accurate, and most importantly, create stories more helpful in healing and in dealing with the situations and feelings that the storytellers experience and in helping them to learn and grow from those experiences. Our current Board of Trustees president, Ann Rostosky, will share with us how she came to edit stories related to her father. Anne?
Thank you, Jerry. Good morning, everyone. My term only goes till the end of the month, though. Thank you all last night for voting in a new president. Jerry twisted my arm to do this today because he didn't have a lot of volunteers. So here you are again with hearing the story about my dad, although I don't think all of you have heard about him. And the reason I chose this title, Things Are Not Always As They Seem, that's actually a quote from Plato, and it means that appearance doesn't always equate to reality. So my dad was a very special man, and growing up, I didn't know that. I thought he didn't love me, but in many ways, he showed his love. I just wasn't aware of that. He had a difficult life. He grew up in Germantown during the Depression, Germantown in Philadelphia. His dad was a roofer. They had a roofing business. And one of the stories he told was he and his brother would have to go collect payment from people. So one would go to the front door, the other would go to the back door to catch the people as they ran out. And then World War II came along. He was in his early 20s, and he enlisted, and he was in, well, now it would be called the Air Force, but at the time it was the Army, Army Air Force, and he was a ball turret gunner in World War II. And he was, his plane was shot down over Italy. So he was in Italy, and an Italian family was trying to hide him, but the Germans saw his boots, and they captured him, and he wound up in prisoner of war camp in Germany. And he had some really, as you can imagine, horrendous experiences, like once in a while they would count off and every so ever many people would be shot. Anyway, this really affected his life. But as a child, you don't know that, you don't understand that. And so maybe my dad wasn't like all the TV sitcom dads, but he loved me, I realize, as an adult. He took good care of our family, he provided for us. He worked for the same company his whole life, Leeds and Northrop in North Wales. Some of you may be familiar with it. And he was an engineer. I was very spoiled by him because he could do everything around our house. He could do electrical work, plumbing, you name it, he could do it. I thought everybody did that. These are all the perceptions that you don't realize until you're an adult. And so as I grew up and learned all these things and learned about what reality is about parents, I feel like I was very blessed to have my father as my dad. And he even, you know, even when my son was growing up, he and my mom would babysit a lot of times, and they did so much for us. We traveled, we went on great family trips. And so I do know now that he loved me in his own way. And so I truly miss him. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Aunt. You know, when you Leeds and Northrop, it's where my mother worked before she had me.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Around the same time, probably would have been the same time. And my aunt worked there. She got my aunt a job. In fact, she was the first person of Italian descent to work in an office there. And they had people working in the plant and so forth, but not in the office. She was the first one ever hired. What'd they say, 6 degrees of separation? Okay. Reverend Matt Alspaugh notes that narrative therapy distinguishes between thin stories and thick stories. Thin stories are brief narratives created for us and often imposed on us by parents, teachers, and a host of other authority figures. Oh, you were never good at math. Remember how you struggled with the multiplication tables, you know? Oh, you were always so lazy, you never pick up after yourself. Right, okay. Those are thin stories, right, okay. Thick stories are those we build out of our own life experiences. Rich with examples, full of detail, Alspaugh writes, thick stories explore inner motives and outward forces that may have made the person act that way. TPUF member Karen McCann is a stalwart member of our TPUF writers group. Her preferred genre is memoir. And our writers group can attest that she has created an impressive repertory of thick stories about people and events that shaped her life. And this morning, she'll share with us remembrance of one of the most important figures in her life, her dad.
Thank you, Jerry. Good morning. John, would you throw up that first picture, please? That's my dad. And his name was Hayes Hirschler. My dad was away in the city all day working. When he came home, he often had more work to do as well, as we lived on a farm where he raised flowers, fruits, and vegetables to sell. He had a master's degree in horticulture, and this was his true passion. The government office job that he had at the Customs House in Philadelphia was merely a way to support everything and everyone. He and mother had two boys, and then they had the prize, the princess, their beloved daughter, moi. And then they had another wonderful daughter 7 years later, my sister Marianne. While I was the only daughter, I was really cherished by my dad. When he'd come home, I'd rush to meet him. He would invariably scoop me up. I'd have a million things to tell him. And sometimes my mother would stop me mid-sentence. She told me there was never anything left to report because I had spilled all the beans of the day. There's a family story of me running to the door one time to greet my dad. I had just finished my bath and didn't bother to put on my jammies. Why bother? It was my daddy coming home. Well, it wasn't. It was Mr. Cressman, who wanted to drop something off for my dad for the Boy Scouts, and so there I was. My dad worked on the farm on the weekends, if not during the week in the evening. It depended on what season it was, what the weather was like. On the weekends, my brothers and I did chores all day Saturday, and sometimes finished up on Sundays after church. But usually we were excused by Saturday late afternoon. My dad would tell me one time what to do, and I was expected to do it. I sometimes didn't understand what he wanted me to do, or more likely, I just was not paying attention, and often was too shy to ask questions. He always seemed to be moving on to the next thing, and there was no time for me to ask something. If I wasn't doing it right, he just usually instructed me again. He never yelled at me. I had to ask Daddy for help with my math, and that was so scary to me. I didn't get it. He couldn't seem to understand why I couldn't get it. He'd get frustrated with me and just sit there and look at me, like I was supposed to be doing something magical to get out of this situation. And that's what it would have taken for me to get this math problem. Magic. It never worked out, as I recall. He and mother danced. They did square dancing, and both of them called the square dance moves. They also did ballroom dancing and were always so incredibly graceful and fun to watch. He tried teaching me how to dance. You'll notice I said tried, because as he put it so simply, something on the order of, you're certainly not graceful like your mother. Well, okay, that squashed my will to learn to dance. I am not a good dancer. I am not graceful like my mother was. I am not pretty to watch dancing. I can't follow a partner in dance. Do I care? No, you can't help it if you're clunky, and I am. Let's concentrate on my other fabulous attributes and not my dancing. Daddy used to say stuff like, your mother looks nice in that color, or is that the style now, or are you really wearing that? Those little statements and questions stick in a young girl's mind. And so I started noticing more what colors I wore, what style I had, and yes, I am wearing this. Dads need to be very careful with daughters, since they hang on every word their dads say. I used to be allowed to go into the city every year, maybe twice a year, with my dad on the train, and then we'd walk the 15 blocks to his office, and there I would meet and greet the people who worked for him. One of his secretaries would often let me use a typewriter, and I'd write, usually love letters to my dad, on the typewriter, and it was a really fun day. We'd go to Horn and Hardart for lunch. They had the first automat in the country. You'd put in your nickel, or maybe a dime was needed, into the slot, look at the sandwiches turning around in the holders, and push the button for your selection. Out would come your sandwich. I'd put it on my tray and then head over to the milk automat machine to select a carton of milk. I often got chocolate milk since we never had that at home. Daddy would let me get whatever it was I wanted to eat that day for lunch. It was a real treat. He'd get something terrible like liverwurst on rye and a cup of coffee. We then would select our desserts. We usually got puddings. And unless they had a beautiful piece of cake in the slot that day, I love cake. Then at 5 o'clock, we'd leave the office and walk back to the train, and Mother would meet us at the Calmer station at 6:25, and we'd head home a whole 5 minutes for dinner and the evening. I always had such a wonderful time at his office. Sometimes one of the staff would take me around, show me other parts of the building, have me meet an incessant amount of people. Everyone seemed to like me a lot. It was either that I was a pleasant, lovable little tyke, or it was that I was the boss's daughter. John, would you switch pictures now? And this next one is me and my dad on my mother and father's 50th wedding anniversary. Daddy taught me how to fish. We went fishing on vacations, and I used to fish with him in Florida when I'd visit them after they were retired. We used to freshwater fish up here in Pennsylvania and in Canada, and we'd fish brackish water in Florida. Brackish water is partly salt water, partly freshwater. There are many fishing stories. One I recall is when he caught a huge eel in Florida. I had to help him because it was very hard to get off the hook to let it go, and my dad never let a fish go with a hook in them. I used a large bath towel to try to hold it. You can hardly hold an eel, honestly. They are slippery and they have a million muscles, so everything moves constantly. Of course, with a hook in your mouth, maybe you'd be moving constantly too. We finally got it, but not before Daddy fell into the water with the eel. I couldn't help laughing. We both went home that day slimy and smelly. Another time we fished, we were in a rowboat, and I kept hearing these noises as we backed into coves and all to fish along the shoreline. I asked what all the noise was about, and Daddy said, "These are Florida frogs. They're huge and they're loud." I said, "Oh." After we got back, he informed me that he had lied to me so that I wouldn't panic. The noises were actually coming from alligators because it was mating season. I said, "And we were backing up close to the shoreline where they hang out?" He said, "I didn't see any, so I wasn't worried, but I knew you would be." I thought to myself, his vision is impaired. I wonder how many are out there. I was younger when we fished in Canada. He used to have to put the worm on for me. I hated doing that. I always felt bad for the worm. He would do that. He'd be trying to get his own line ready. A fish would grab my worm. I didn't try to hook it because I wasn't paying attention, so the worm was gone. I'd need another worm put on, and he still wasn't fishing yet. He was still helping me. And then I'd want a snack. And then I'd have to go to the bathroom. Oh, my poor dad. Those fishing trips. When we'd get back, Mother would always ask, "So, how was the fishing?" One time he said to her, "Ask Karen, I don't remember fishing at all." Oops, thanks, Daddy. I also remember him asking me to please stop talking. The fish can hear you and they won't bite. I wonder. In those days, Mother did everything with us as far as discipline went. Daddy never got involved unless it was with the boys. He and I talked a lot when I was older. I don't remember talking much to him about everyday life when I was younger. I usually talked to my mother about those things. I do remember him always saying, though, "You can do everything your brothers do," and that gave me some confidence. That did not mean becoming a Boy Scout, however, like they did, or going camping with my dad's troop, like they did, but I got the meaning as I grew up. Dad was stoic and very measured. He was very careful with money, and we always thought we were poor because he didn't buy much. That whole generation saved and saved, and then when they retired, they had all the money they needed. A good plan. So that was something else he taught all of us, how to save. We'd put half of our allowances in our piggy banks always. As opposed to Ann's dad, my dad was not good at fixing mechanical things that needed fixing. In those days, you rarely took something out to get fixed, you tried to do it yourself. I never heard my dad curse, except when he was trying to fix something, like the mower or the tractor or the furnace or the toilet. I used to get ingrown toenails when I was younger. He was always the one who sterilized the needle and then gently dug my toenail out of the side of my toe, put mercurochrome on it and a Band-Aid. He was also my official splinter taker outer. He could always get that darn thing out, and I was always getting one because we played a lot in the barn. I used to look forward to 6:30 when Daddy would be home. Then it just seemed like all was well in the house. Dad taught me to think for myself, and that is what has led me to TPUF. My dad passed in 2005 at the age of 98. Happy Father's Day to all you dads. Thank you.
Before I share a little story with you this morning, I'd like to play a clip from the movie Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams is a textbook example of magical realism in filmmaking. How many of you have seen the movie? More than once? Okay. I think I've seen it at least a half dozen times, right? You know, the basic storyline, Ray Kinsella, an Iowa farmer with a wife, Annie, and a daughter, Karen, is compelled by a series of strange and puzzling visions and happenings to take a sizable acreage of his farm and turn it into a baseball field. Miraculously, magically, players of bygone eras appear and begin practicing and playing baseball on this ball field built in the middle of nowhere. The personal and profound reason for this enterprise is revealed when the catcher on one of the teams removes his mask and Ray comes face to face with his past and with the longing for connection to someone he realizes he never really knew or understood. John, would you roll that film clip?
If you build it, he will come.
Oh my God.
What is it?
It's my father. Ease his pain.
Distance.
It was you.
No, Ray. It was you.
Ray. saw him years later when he was worn down by life. Look at him. He's got his whole life in front of him, and I'm not even a glint in his eye. What do I say to him?
Why don't you introduce him to his granddaughter?
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to thank you folks for putting up this field, letting us play here. I'm John Kinsella.
I'm Ray. My wife, Annie. This is my daughter, Karen. Karen, this is my... This is John.
Hi, John.
Hiya, Karen.
Well, we're gonna let you two talk. I mean, if all these people are gonna come, we got a lot of work to do. It's very nice meeting you.
Ma'am.
Come on in.
Catch a good game.
Thank you. It's so beautiful here.
For me.
Well, for me, it's like a dream come true. Can I ask you something? Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.
Iowa?
Yeah.
Could have sworn it was heaven.
Is there a heaven?
Place dreams come true.
Maybe this is heaven.
I'd like that.
A blog post that said there are two kinds of men, ones who cry at the end of Field of Dreams and ones who deny crying at the end of Field of Dreams. That scene really resonates with me. I could say that growing up, I really didn't know my father. Not that I didn't know his name or recognize his face, not that he wasn't around. He rarely did anything that didn't involve the family. Well, once a month he played pinochle with a bunch of guys from the old neighborhood in South Philadelphia. But even then, sometimes they played at our house. Now, he was there almost every evening during the week, and when he wasn't trying to earn a few extra bucks, on Saturdays and Sundays too. He worked hard all day, came straight home, looked for a few hours to relax, read the paper, do the crossword puzzle, He did crossword puzzles up until almost the day he died at the age of 95. Watched some TV. He and I didn't talk that much. We didn't spend what today we would refer to as quality time together. He did teach me to play the ukulele and later some guitar, but I couldn't say we connected as teacher and pupil. He'd married at 35, had me at 37, had a daughter at 39, and another daughter, Joyce, who's here with me today, at 44. By the time I reached my teens, he was 50 years old. He was a relic of another time and place. I didn't see him as a role model or a mentor. He was, in the parlance of the 60s, my old man. He was better at figuring out how to father a daughter than a son, although frankly, he wasn't too comfortable with young kids in general. My mother tried to explain that by saying, you know, he really didn't have a childhood. By that, she meant that his earliest years weren't a time of innocent fun, of carefree and free living, right? He was the fourth child in an immigrant family of 10 children, growing up during the Great Depression. From an early age, he was saddled with responsibility for younger siblings. I was told that to help supplement income, his mother opened a little store on the first floor of their three-story house on Mifflin Street, right below 10th in Philadelphia. At the age of four, he was selling apples out on the street and serving water ice at a penny a cup outside the house. With a metal scraper, in the heat of summer, he clawed away at a thick block of ice. No machine to do that work, right? According to family legend, he often brought in more money selling those penny cups of water ice than the rest of the store brought in. That's why that scene from Field of Dreams really grabs my heart. When Ray sees his father for the first time as a young man with hopes and dreams and a future filled with possibilities, what does he say about his father? I only saw him years later when he was worn down by life. Look at him. He's got his whole life before him, and I'm not even a glint in his eye. Well, I could go on for hours about how I constantly had to edit the story of my father, of me and my father, as I matured and he aged. Like, how was he able to introduce me to music? Well, back then, I don't know if you're familiar, there was something called the Settlement House Movement. That was basically upper middle and upper class people would set up these community houses in poor immigrant neighborhoods, and they would bring them there and they would give them lessons in doing various things, including music. And the idea was, of course, that you would then help others who came in. And I remember one time we were watching, remember Perry Como? And he had a segment on the show that was Dear Perry. People would write in and request a song. And if you remember, generally he would sing only with and a guitar accompaniment. The guitarist was a man named Tony Mottola, who had been a student of my father's at the Settlement House in Philadelphia. Right? He became a professional musician, like two of his brothers, right? And then he was drafted into the Army at the age of 32. He said they were scraping the bottom of the barrel at that time, right? They sent him over to repair seats on Jeeps because he had been trained as an upholsterer, right? But he actually rose up in the ranks. He left the Army as a master sergeant. When he reported to base, they tested all the recruits. There were about 900 of them that came in on that one train, right? He placed in the top three in the testing. So they pulled him aside and they said, we want to send you to officer's candidate school. But he didn't have a high school diploma. He had only finished the eighth grade, because he had had to constantly drop out of school to help support the family. At one point, he was sent up to New York to a relative's newsstand up there, and he worked there for a year and, of course, sent money back home. Right. Well, once he married, he settled down. And only in the last few years of his life did he tell me about a lot of what was going on in his life at that time, about playing guitar in Atlantic City clubs, for example, until 2 in the morning, and then catching the train that ran from Atlantic City to Philadelphia, right? And then working as an upholsterer, right? Catching the train at the end of that, going back to Atlantic City and playing, right? He was very proud of the fact that in Atlantic City was really a hotbed of jazz. And so at the time, you know, Nina Simone got her start in a club in Atlantic City, right? And he said he was very proud. One day the guy came up and he said, "You're the best guitarist in Atlantic City right now." Right. So for the rest of his life, he worked as an upholsterer, right? And he didn't retire until what, he was 82? 79. He finally retired fully when he was 79 years old. As I matured and aged, I had to rewrite the story of my father many times. I would never claim that our relationship was ideal or exemplary. In fact, many of the things I tried to do as a dad were things that felt he hadn't done, right? But the thicker the story became, the more I could understand his feelings, forgive his shortcomings, appreciate his resilience, and the more I could empathize with a life of sacrifice and devotion to family. And editing that story amplified my capacity, sorry, for compassion and resilience. I could always say, damn, if my father could overcome the obstacles he faced in life without all the advantages I've had, damn it, I'm going to make it. Merging themes of fathering, storytelling, and freedom as I was working on this service affected me much more deeply than I could have imagined. I'd encourage everyone, if you haven't already done it, to do some proofreading and editing of the stories you retell of fathering and being fathered. You'll not just learn more about the father and the father figures in your life, you'll learn a whole heap about yourself. Even inadvertently, you'll happen upon truths that help set your spirit free, free from limiting ideas and feelings of the past, free from the burden of whys and what ifs, free to be more loved and more loving. So be it. It's time now for Matters of the Heart, and I believe Flo is going to conduct our Matters of the Heart this morning.
Life comes at us with waves of joy and sorrow. When those waves become too much for us to hold by ourselves, we share. Let us now take a moment to share into this caring community any matter that we hold in our heart which spills out for support or celebration. Online, you can let the host know. In person, you can come forward and speak briefly into the microphone. Please start with your name. Come, let us share together.
We can bring this time of sharing to a close. And we will be singing Spirit of Life. This version will be performed by the choir of the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Northfield, Minnesota. And you're welcome to sing along, standing or sitting, however you would like.
Sing in the hand.
Anyone can become a father, but it takes someone special to become a dad. So said Hall of Fame third baseman Wade Boggs. What makes that difference? Our closing song provides an answer. The words are an adaptation of chapter 13, verses 1 to 3 of the Apostle Paul's first letter to the Christian community of Corinth, referred to today simply as not Corinthians 1, but 1 Corinthians. Let's sing these words mindfully to acknowledge the transforming power of love that's not self-centered or self-serving, the kind of love we hope to give and receive as fathers and father figures. The choir of South Church Unitarian Universalist Congregation, Portsmouth, New Hampshire, will lead us in singing, Though I May Speak with Bravest Fire. Light, and on this Father's Day 2025, we embrace the light of memory, the light that illumines our past and connects us in a complex matrix with those who gave us life, and if we were fortunate, blessed our lives with their presence, their wisdom, their guidance, their love. In our relationships, may we carry forward that light and share it deliberately, unconsciously, with all those whose lives we touch and whose lives touch our own. Please stay with us for announcements and for the postlude, Bob Dylan's Forever Young, performed by Pete Seeger and the Rivertown Kids.